thank Pastor Benny for inviting me to come here to share with you. When I flew over, my flight had problem taking off because Boston was blanketed in snow. And it's great to see that LA is in such a... Is it working? I hope it's working. Doesn't work. Oh, here. Okay, so this is the passage. All right. So I want to share with you the story of Jacob. I need my PowerPoint because I was born in the year of the monkey. So this is the year of the monkey, right? So if you work it out, I'm 96 years old. You know that. So my memory is failing me. That's number one. Number two, it's not often that you hear a psychiatrist speak to you. Psychiatrists are not supposed to speak. They're supposed to listen. So I need my PowerPoint to make sure that I say the right things to you. All right, so Jacob, I want to share with you the story of Jacob. Jacob is a well-known figure. If you grew up in Sunday school, you know probably a lot about him. So he was one of the patriarchs, and he was the third generation, Abraham, Isaac, and then Jacob. So Jacob had a hard life. Why did he have a hard life? He was unloved by his father. His father, Isaac, was a very weak father. I think that it doesn't take a lot of imagination for you to see that. Possibly because when he was a teenager, his father, Abraham, tried to sacrifice him. Now, if you imagine that you are 19, 18 years old and your father tried to put you on the altar and sacrifice you, what kind of effect would that have on the rest, on you and for the rest of your life, you see? So it was a very difficult experience. Now, of course, in Sunday school, you never talk about that. You always talk about how great Abraham is to be willing to sacrifice Isaac. Very few people actually think about what effect that would have on Isaac as a person. So anyway, Isaac turned out to be a very weak person. He was always, he had trouble. He had a lot of trouble. And so Isaac actually favored Esau, the older of the twins. Because Esau was a very different person than Isaac. Isaac was weak and timid and afraid, nervous and afraid to make decisions. He actually he wasn't very involved in life at all. And the Bible has very little to say about him. There are only about one or two passages, one or two chapters in Genesis that talk about Isaac. In contrast to Jacob, the Bible, Genesis, spent a lot of print on the life of Jacob. So anyway, Esau was a character that's, you know, he kind of couldn't care less. He just did whatever he pleases. He was a very free person, if you like, in our terms. He wasn't bothered by customs or regulations. He just did whatever he wanted to do. So that kind of a character that's very different from Isaac's, because Isaac was always careful. He was afraid to do anything out of line. So people who have little confidence are attracted to people that have a different set of makeup than yourself. So you see that sometimes men or women choose their partners in that way. If you're somebody that have little confidence, you choose somebody that's not like you at all. All right, so if you're very quiet, you don't want to talk, you choose a girlfriend that talks all the time, that talks for you, that thinks for you, makes decisions for you. And that's exactly what Isaac did. He chose a wife, Rebecca, who did all the decisions for him. So if you lack confidence, you want somebody who's different than you because you don't like yourself. And you want somebody who's different than you. Rebecca, on the other hand, was very confident. So Rebecca, she chose to love Jacob because Jacob is like her. Jacob is very forceful, very smart, very capable, very tenacious. He would go for things. He would really struggle to get what he wants. So for people who are confident, you choose somebody who's like you. For people who are not confident, you choose somebody who's unlike you. Okay, so you ask yourself, it's good for you to kind of look at yourself in this way. All right, so the story of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob and Jacob's sons, and Joseph particularly. You can learn a lot about life in the family. Unfortunately, unfortunately, that's the only family that the Bible describes, the whole Bible. Genesis is the only book that describes a family. For instance, if you look at King David, you don't know much about his family. You only know that he was the youngest, but how was his relationship to his family? You have very little idea. So I don't know why. The Bible is, I guess, not a book that talks about family dynamics or psychology. So it's very hard to use the Bible to do counseling. Those of you who are interested in biblical counseling, I hope you take this to heart. It's very difficult to use the Bible for counseling people because the Bible is not organized in a biblical counseling way. I'm sorry, I cough a lot because I have an irregular. About a few weeks ago, I developed an irregular heartbeat, and every time my heart beats irregularly, I tend to cough because it tucks on my vagus nerve. And I asked to see the cardiologist, and he said he'll call me back, but he's never called me back. So I said to myself, by the time he gets to see me, I'll probably be with God. So anyway, it doesn't matter, you know, it's all right. You don't have to have a heart that works all the time. You just have need a heart that works most of the time. So anyway, so Jacob is, he had a terrible life because he had no father to love him. He had no father to guide him. Jacob never gives him spiritual teaching. So the two boys basically grew up in a very secular family because they had no idea how to relate to God. But anyway, so this is Jacob. Okay, so he had to struggle with the help of his mother Rebecca, Isaac's blessing, and also the honor of being the firstborn. Then, of course, after that, he had to flee for safety. And you know how he get father's blessing for that? Because Rebecca made up a story. Rebecca knew that Jacob was in trouble because Esau wanted to kill Jacob for the fact that Jacob stole the father's blessing. All right, so in those days, when you want to leave home, you have to get permission from your father to do that, I guess. These days, of course, you can come and go as you please, and you never ask if you want to stay until 3 o'clock in the morning. You don't even call home, right? So you know that it's different now. So it's very difficult to kind of relate to a story like that. But anyway, for Jacob to go away from home, he had to get the father's blessing. So that's why when Jesus was talking about the prodigal son, okay, you now realize that those were very different times and days. Anyhow, Rebecca made up the story that, so she said to Isaac, if Jacob were to take wives like Esau did from the Canaanites, my life would be not worth living. All right, so for that reason, he put the blame on Esau. Not that Esau's blameless, but not for that reason, you know. But Rebecca had to get Isaac to agree to bless Jacob for the journey. So she made up this story to get Isaac to agree to let Jacob go. So, all right, so Jacob left. He actually had to flee for his safety. But actually, he got his father's blessing for that. Then, of course, he went to live with Laban. And Laban became his father-in-law, and he cheated Jacob out of a lot of things. So he struggled for 20 years. He struggled for 20 years under Laban, and then he had the sisters as wives, Leah and Rachel. And the two sisters, of course, they fight each other all the time. So by the time he came to the story, Genesis 32, where we're going to read, he already had 11 sons. And the 11 sons all fight with each other. So he had a very difficult time. Jacob's life was a very hard life, very difficult life. He toiled without rest for 20 years, and then he had to flee from Laban to go home. Then he reached a point of crisis because he heard that Esau was coming to meet him. And his first reaction was, this is terrible. Esau's going to kill me, kill my family, and what I've worked for 20 years is going to come to nothing. So his life was in crisis. All right, so he prayed. He was scared, fearful, and distressed. He was on the verge of total loss. So in great fear and distress, Jacob prayed, "Oh God, my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, save me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau. I'm afraid that he will come and attack me and will also attack the mothers and their children." So he was desperate. He knew at that point he had come to the limits of himself. Now, let me take one step back, because you're talking about spiritual and mental health, right? Well, actually, it's true that you should not eat so much, you know. The USA has done a very lengthy experiment on rhesus monkeys. They got a hold of 50 rhesus monkeys. Half of them were fed a third of what normal monkeys would eat, and the other half ate whatever they wanted. And after 20 years, those monkeys that were fed were underfed actually were very healthy. I actually did not think of showing you the slides. You can see that there's a tremendous difference between the monkeys that are underfed and the monkeys that are well fed. So the monkeys that are well fed are old and weary, and they lost a lot of hair. And you look at them and you see that their eyes has no gleam in it. They look very tired. They look very fat. And the lean monkeys were very healthy. They had a coat of glossy hair. They look very young, you know. So if you look at me, you will know that I don't eat a lot. Now, okay, so what's the problem? So the U.S. government actually wanted to recruit old people to go on this experiment and say, oh, all right, suppose you eat less. You'll be a lot healthier. You'll be a lot better be able to control your blood pressure, your blood sugar, and so on. The American Geriatric Society people said, no, we don't want anything to do with that. Why is that? Because the monkeys that were underfed and healthy were actually very unhappy. Why were they unhappy? Because they're hungry all the time. So the monkeys that are underfed, they stay at one corner of the area. They don't associate themselves with the other monkeys. They sit all day by themselves, groom themselves, and if you try to approach them, they'll try and bite you. So you know that these monkeys, despite the fact they have great physical health, they have actually a terrible mental health. Now, so that's a dilemma we face, you know. You solve one problem, you sometimes create another. But that's an aside. What I'm trying to tell you now, so it's true that you should not eat too much if you want physical health. So the American old people said, we want to be happy. We don't want health. Who cares about health? We want happiness. All right, so the U.S. government... So actually, the U.S. government don't know what to do with it. They probably have to close down the experiment. They have to shut it down after 25 years. They don't know what to do about it. All right, so the point is, what I'm trying to make is that sometimes you solve one problem and you create another one. But that, anyway, I don't have time to get into all that. Okay, anyhow. All right. So all health issues are, in fact, an interaction of gene and environment, G and E, okay? For short, gene and environment. If you ask me what is gene, then you have to go back to biology class. Okay, nature and nurture. What? In other words, it's nature and nurture. All right, we cannot change our genes, right? I mean, there are only very few illnesses these days that you can actually, since 2009, the NIH has actually allowed doctors to treat a few illnesses by changing genes. But that's very small number. It's not easy to change genes, and you just don't know what the effects are. So generally, by and large, you can never change your genes. But we can shape our environment. All right, this is what we want to focus on. You can shape your environment. You have to take charge of it. You have to take charge by the help of God to change the environment. Because it's gene and environment interaction, half of it you can't change. So you do your best to change the other half of it. So for instance, not eating so much is actually controlling the environment, right? It turns out it's good for your physical health, not so good for your mental health. So what about the other aspects of your mental health? I'll talk about that. So environment, you can basically look at it as adverse and beneficial. What are adverse environments? Bullying, if you went to school, grade school, and you were bullied, then of course that would leave a scar on you. It leaves a scar not on your heart. It leaves a scar in a part of your brain called amygdala. Okay, so we do monkey experiments all the time. So you can abuse monkeys. All right, after you abuse the monkeys and you cut out their brain to look at what changes the bullying or abuse did to the brain, you can actually see that in the amygdala there are lines of brain cell deaths. You can actually see lines on the amygdala, tracks left by dead brain cells. So it does hurt you. Bullying hurts people. It hurts people by killing parts of their brain. Okay, all right. All right, bullying, lack of warmth and caring. If you have a family that doesn't love you, is an adverse environment. Broken relationships, bad habits that you develop yourself, unemployment, financial problems, etc., etc. I don't need to go into all that. You know that. Okay. What are beneficial environments? For Christians, God's intervention, your own faith, I'll come to that, and Christian love, the love of Christian community, brothers and sisters. Okay, so Jacob's adverse environment. I already talked about it. The upbringing, not his father's favorite, a strong mother and weak father, that's always an unbalance in the parental relationship, is always bad for the children. No spiritual teaching from Isaac. competed and struggled with Esau. He competed and struggled with everybody. So Jacob's lifestyle is to struggle. And that's the level God met him at. Jacob wrestled with everybody. Jacob fights with everybody. It's the whole point here. He had to fight. He's learned that he has to fight to gain, to get what he wants. Because nothing's given to him. He was the second born of the twins. He was not the favorite of the father. So he had to struggle to get it. And as he grew up, he learned to struggle. And that's his personality. He struggled with Laban. He struggled with his wives. The conflict of his wife was a source of grief to him. And of course, the jealousy among his sons. You know that. Joseph was sold. These all have an adverse effect on his mental health. So you know that he was not mentally sick. Right? Mental illness, depression, and anxiety are different. They are not the same as mental health. So faith is important for your mental health. But if you develop depression and anxiety, it is not necessarily because you lack faith or because you don't have a good spiritual relationship with God. Okay? That's different. All right, so for instance, suppose you face a crisis and you can't sleep, whereas your wife or your husband sleeps well, and he or she will say to you, "Look at me, I have great faith. We face the same worries, and yet I can go to sleep, and I have no problem eating, and I feel happy. You have no faith. That's why you don't sleep. You worry all the time, and so on." If he tells you that, or if she tells you that, all you need to say to him or her is, "Thank God you have good genes." It's not because you have good faith, okay? Trust me. Because you want to have the same faith, it's just that you cannot exercise it. So, it is not because you lack faith that you develop a mental illness, okay? I don't want you to get that misunderstanding. I know that there are people that teach that, or at least they used to. I hope you don't believe in that anymore. In any case, faith has an effect on your mental health. Okay, so you can count on it. Your relationship with God will affect your mental health. Why is that? We'll come back to that issue later. Alright, so these are all the problems that Jacob had to face, and they all have an adverse effect on his mental health. But the beneficial side is God's intervention, God's grace. It's God's grace that Jacob was able to hold everything together. How? God's graciousness. He was very gracious to Jacob. He promised him blessing, and he promised him, God promised him protection. That saved the day for Jacob. So God has given, on top of that, the graciousness and the promises and the protection, God gave Jacob a lot of strength. He was very smart, he was very resourceful, and he was tenacious. He didn't give up easily. He was willing to hold on to God. And by grace, Jacob was wise to choose to wrestle with God at that moment, the passage that we read this morning. And by grace, he knew that his own brokenness, he knew his own brokenness, he knew that he was a broken man. I'll come to that later. And ask God to fix his life. So why did God come to wrestle with him? Because at that critical moment, he had room for God. When you don't come to a crisis, sometimes you're content. Sometimes you say, I can shut God out. I don't need God. Okay, you read in that, you saw in that video, God is just one app on your iPhone. So if you don't need it, if you don't need to use it, forget God. That's a problem. But when you're in a crisis, when Jacob was in crisis, he knew. He had come to the end of his own resourcefulness. He needed God. It was on this level of, one, a point of crisis that God reached him. And you can see that God came to wrestle with him. Isn't that evidence of God's graciousness? He doesn't come and sit down and talk to Jacob, because there's no talking to that man. He doesn't want to talk to you. He wants to struggle with you. So God came to struggle with Jacob. He come and meet you on your level. He'll come and meet you on your level if you let him. It's the point. All right. So God came to struggle with Jacob. Why did he choose to do that? Why didn't he just tell Jacob, look, listen, don't worry about it. I'll tell Esau to go away and he won't hurt you. Why didn't he do that? Because God wanted to change Jacob first. He wanted to fix the person. He didn't want to just fix his trouble. He wanted to fix Jacob as a person. So God had to struggle with Jacob first, deal with the person first, before he handled Jacob's troubles. God wanted to change Jacob first, because Jacob was his own worst enemy. We are all our own worst enemy. You can believe that. You might think that your father, your husband, your wife, your boyfriend, your girlfriend are the worst problems. Maybe, but a lot of times, you are your own worst enemy. And God had to deal with Jacob first, because Jacob was his own worst enemy. Jacob's troubles are bad, but God didn't want to fix the environment. He wanted to fix Jacob first. Then he'll turn to fix his problems. So how did God bless Jacob? God blessed Jacob by defeating him. He beat him. How did he beat Jacob? He wrenched Jacob's hip. Now the hip, if you do anatomy, you know that the hip is the strongest joint on the human body. It's very difficult to cut open or to wrench the hip. When you're old, you break your hip bone, but the hip joint is a very strong joint. When God touched Jacob's hip and wrenched it out of socket, Jacob knew at that instant, this has to be superhuman. This can't be just human, a person that I'm wrestling with. If he had the strength to wrench my hip socket, he has to be God. So Jacob knew. Jacob knew that that must be God. And what did he do? He asked for God's blessing. He was wise. He didn't ask God All right, why don't you fix my hip? God says, what's your name? Jacob. God says you should not be called Jacob anymore. Call yourself, or I'll call you Israel. So what is God saying? God says that I don't want you to be struggling with other people. I don't want you to be struggling with everybody you meet. That's toxic. That's bad for you. That's bad for you as a patriarch. That's bad for you as somebody they have chosen. It's not good for you to be struggling with people. You should only struggle with God in prayer. That's the change. That is the change. God wants him to change from being himself, fighting with everybody, into somebody who holds on to God. So in brokenness, and doing by that, he broke his hip, or he wrenched his hip out of, pulled his femur out of the socket. From then on, he was limping. He couldn't struggle physically very well, and that's a good metaphor for God to remind him that you should not be struggling, wrestling with people, fighting with people all the time. You should hold on to me as God. This is how God changed him. So in brokenness, he was healed. He became humble. He quit his toxic struggles with everybody. He was a changed person. If you read on, you can see that he was a changed person. Not perfect, but he was changed. In defeat, God allowed Jacob to become whole. Jacob learned to put God first. He learned to lean on God. He knew that all good things came from God, not from his own struggles. Not that you don't need to struggle. It's not that you can just sit there and not do anything. It's not true. But you work with God. If you struggle in life, you struggle with God in your life. God gives you whatever good things you have in life. If you're smart, it's because he made you so. If you have good genes and you can sleep through a night in times of trouble, it's because God gave you the good genes. If you are tenacious, hardworking, resourceful, it's because God made you that way. All good things come from God. Jacob realized that. Even in life, when bad things happen to you, and I pray they don't, it's a new year tomorrow, and it's bad to talk about, it's not good to talk about bad things happening. But the fact is, bad things are going to happen. There's just no escape from it. You are going to get bad things in your life. But if you have God, and that's what Jacob learned, even when bad things happen to you, if you are in a walking relationship, if you are in a close relationship with God, like the fact was that Jacob was crippled, it actually became a blessing to him. Bad things can be turned by God into blessings for you. I'll show you an example of that later on. All right, so God cared enough to come and wrestle with Jacob. Why? Because struggle is wrestling, is Jacob's style, is his life. You can't talk to him. There are people that talk, there are people that struggle. There are people that do both. But still, God came on his level to meet him. God will come in your level to meet you if you allow him. That's his style. So God met him there. And God was gracious enough to wrestle with him. And in the wrestling with Jacob, it's like the word became flesh. Jesus came to meet us on our turf, on our level, on our terms. And he still does that today, if you let him. I hope you allow him to do that. Okay, let me step back and talk about psychology and faith now. So in the 50s and, so in the, no, actually not 50s, in the 20s, starting with Freud gave a lecture at Clark University. Freud was completely unknown in the USA until he went to Clark in Pennsylvania to give a lecture on Introduction to Psychoanalysis in 1915, I think it was. And he became very famous overnight. So from 1915 to about 1980, the academic psychology field and psychiatry field was very antagonistic, extremely antagonistic to faith. They think that Christian faith is just immature, infantile is that term. Immature, infantile is a fantasy. It's your unhealthy projection. It's worse things than that. Okay, so there's no good, nothing good about Christian faith when it comes to mental health. So if you invited me to come here in 1975 to talk about it, I don't know what I'll say to you, because I don't know what to say in the face of all these antagonistic comments from psychologists and psychiatrists. This is Freud. So he said, God is an illusion. Belief in God is an infantile need for a father figure, things like that. And then, of course, after psychoanalysis went kind of out of fashion, it was followed by cognitive therapy. And this is Albert Ellis. Albert Ellis is a founder of cognitive therapy. So he said, very much in the same vein as Freud, belief in God is just a reflection of childhood dependency. Where's the proof that God cares about you? He would ask his patients, if his patients bring up stories about their faith, he'd tell them, what proof do you have that God cares about you at all? Things like that. It was very destructive. It was very destructive to Christians that go and see him. But these days, things change. Because in 1990, there's a professor, Harold Koenig, at Duke University. You know where Duke University is? You're on the West Coast. You probably don't know that there's a world outside of California. But that's all right. Okay, so at Duke, there was a very good Christian professor. He said, all right, so you guys think that faith is bad for mental health. Well, let's find evidence for it then. Why talk about theory? We don't know if it's true. Why don't we show if there's data to prove that? So he single-handedly started the whole field of faith, the effect of faith on mental and physical health. After about 10 years, his results were so amazing and surprising that it caused a paradigm shift. His research found overwhelming evidence that faith is good for mental and physical health. So it's not just that, you know, eating less is good for physical health, but not for mental health. Faith is good for both mental and physical health. So that's his finding, okay? So thereafter, all researchers have to, if you conduct outcome research now and you apply for a grant to the NIH, and if you don't put in a section on the effect of your subject's faith on their outcome, you're unlikely to get the grant. That's how the field has changed. So there's a paradigm shift. There was no more attack on faith now. So you shouldn't be afraid if you go to see a secular psychiatrist or a therapist. At most, they'll not talk to you about it, but they won't attack you like Albert Ellis or Freud did. They just leave you alone, let you be, and say you should talk to your pastor about it or something. Anyhow, so there's this fantastic shift in paradigm now. The evidence, it's what counts, not opinion or theory. In science, it's always the same. All right, so faith in God, why does it help? I'll come to this point. Why does faith in God help your mental and physical health? Because number one, it gives you meaning. Secondly, it gives you purpose. Thirdly, it gives you self-control. Fourthly, because your faith allows you to live in a community of love, in a church, for instance, a fellowship, a small group. There's love, and the love supports you. So these are the four elements. Okay, how do I know that? Because tons of research have done what is called factor analysis. So you look at what people say about how their faith helped them, and breaks down to four factors. One, meaning. Two, purpose. Three, self-control. Fourth, love. These are all good for mental and physical health. So what is the current research? The current research. So 25 years after Koenig started this field of faith in effect of faith on health research, the field is now moving beyond now. We're no longer debating about whether faith is good for you. We know it's good for you. The point now is, why is faith good for you? And the research is, how does faith How do these four elements, meaning, purpose, self-control, and love, how do they change the wiring in your brain? And how do they change your brain function? You see my point? We are not content to settle at faith helps your physical and mental health. We want to know what are the mechanisms, what is the mechanism that faith helps you? Through what mechanism, through what change in your brain structure, in your brain wiring, how does it help you? This is where the field is now. The field is way beyond counseling now. So you see many Christians go into Christian counseling and so on. Of course, nobody listens to me. There are no Christian psychiatrists, very few Christian psychiatrists. There are no Christians that do neuroscience research. You know, 10,000 medical school graduates each year in the USA. There are 10,000 medical school graduates. 2,000 of them are Chinese. All right, so because the medical schools put a limit on how many Chinese they would allow to go into medical school. This is an open secret. So the Asians in Massachusetts, it's an open, well, you know, it's here, you search the web. So the Asians in Massachusetts are taking Harvard to court. They're bringing a lawsuit against Harvard now. They brought that up last year because they said Harvard discriminates against Asians because they put a limit on how many students, Asian students, they would accept into Harvard. They put a cap at 20 or 25%. If you look at all the top universities, and the data is available on the web, if you search it, so just don't just Google about, you know, monkeys and effect of food on health and so on. Google about these things. Okay, if you look at all the top schools, the only school, you may be surprised to know that, the only school that does not place a limit or a permanent limit on Asians going to a school is the California Institute of Technology. You look at the web and you know, okay? All the other schools, including Harvard, Duke, Yale, Hopkins, Princeton, Columbia, Chicago, things like that, they all put a gap on 20%. So now Asians are bringing a lawsuit against Harvard. But anyway, I was come back to my point. Okay, so my point is that there are 2,000 Chinese medical school graduates each year from the American medical schools. Nobody, none of them. In my 45 years as a professor at Tufts, I've never seen a Christian Chinese medical school graduate go into psychiatry or neuroscience research. Nobody wants to do that. What they do, they go into ophthalmology, they go into dermatology, they go to plastic surgery, they go to anesthesia, they go to pathology. You ask your friends around you, who takes up psychiatry? Who takes up neuroscience research? What am I trying to say? I speak, hopefully not from bitterness. What I want to say is that we need to get involved in this field of research because neuroscience is going to present a major challenge to the Christian faith in the 21st century. Mark my words. They are going to bring up questions. They are going to be tough for Christians to answer unless we have our own researchers in that field to know what's going on. So for instance, there's a recent research that puts the autistic gene, one autistic gene, into a monkey and breed the monkey for two generations. Both generations of monkeys develop autistic traits. So what's so, it's an interesting research, right? It's extremely interesting, I think. But it brings up the question of how much can you change a monkey's genome because the monkey becomes human, you see? These are critical questions. Suppose you put half of the human genome, disease genome, into a monkey. Does the monkey become half a human person? These are questions. You don't get answers in Christian counseling, I tell you that, okay? You have to go into research to do that. I'm speaking to most of you because you're smart. You go into medical school, you go into great research. Anyway, I've said enough now. Anyhow, okay, let me come to my close because I know I have to end. Although I could go on and talk for another hour, despite the fact that I'm 96 years old. Okay, all right, so despite the fact that we don't know the mechanisms of why faith works for us. You say, well, it's not important. Well, maybe it is, but maybe it isn't. I want to tell you about George King. Who's George King? George King is a China Inland Mission missionary. When he was young, he had infection in one of his foot, and because in those days there's no antibiotic, so the surgeon had to amputate his leg. So he only has one leg. And when he grew up, so that's a big inconvenience, particularly in those days that people with disabilities are looked down upon. So when he grew up, he wanted to apply to join the CIM, China Inland Mission. And three times it was rejected. Why they reject him? Because they said, you can't come go to China with only one leg. It's not possible. It's too hard a life for you. We can't take care of you. You can't come to be our missionary. All right, so he wouldn't give up. So after the third time he failed, he said, I want to talk to Hudson Taylor himself. I want to speak to him. Give me a chance. So Hudson Taylor said, okay. After hearing his story, Hudson Taylor said, You can serve God. You can pray for CIM. Just stay in England. You only have one leg. Just stay in England, pray for us. God will value your service. What did George King say? He said, but those with both legs are not willing to go to China. That's why I want to go. Hudson Taylor was very touched. He let him go. And you know what George King did? He established the Wenzhou Church. Do you know where Wenzhou is? If you don't know that there's a world outside California, why would you care about where Wenzhou is, right? Okay, so George King established the Wenzhou Church. Wenzhou Church is the church that's really the machine in China that's driving, that God has used to drive the growth of the Chinese church in China. So you can see that God can use a person's disability. Let me come to my last slide. Oh, no, that's the second to last slide. We all have a Jacob in us. Maybe you are going through trials, crisis, you have a hard life, and you're worried, distressed. Be open to God. This is my honest advice to you. Choose Christ in faith. Choose to walk with Christ in faith. Allow Jesus to come to engage and transform you first before you ask him to solve your problem. And you live in a Christian community to grow in the mental and spiritual health because they will hopefully give you love. Without Christ, even good things ultimately turn to emptiness. You know that. You may chase after that, but without Christ, all good things come to naught. In Christ, even bad things can bring blessing. Look at George King. He had one leg amputated, and yet he was able to accomplish great things for God. Let me remind those of us who perhaps are struggling with depression and anxiety. Now, that's beyond mental health now. That's mental illness. Faith has a lot to help mental health. But if you have depression and anxiety, it is not because you lack faith, or because your spiritual life is bad. It's nothing to do with that. It is usually because your genes are not what they should be, or because you've had a hard life. God allowed you to have so many environmental stresses that they interact with your genes and give you anxiety and depression. So how can you deal with it in faith? First of all, you affirm yourself. You affirm your illness. You said, I can glorify God even in illness. George King can glorify God even with one leg. You can glorify God in depression or anxiety. Yesterday I was talking about a Christian who was really crazy. He thought he had the delusion that he was the second Messiah. How can God use such a person? But God did. The organization that he set up became the Spedford Foundation for Orphans, became a blessing to the land of Palestine in the 19th century. You go to the Library of Congress and look up Spedford Foundation for Orphans. You see that story. Horatio Spedford had a hard life and he became bipolar, but God used him. In those days, there was no treatment. Don't be discouraged. Affirm it. You can glorify God even in illness. And illness can be a blessing to God. Remember George King. If God allows you to develop a mental problem, seek help from the church and from God. Hold on to God. Hold on to Christians to encourage you. Of course, if Christians tell you that you must have committed some sins that you have not confessed, just tell them to come and talk to me. Also, you should get help from mental health professionals. Now, suppose if you have a broken leg, won't you go to see an orthopedic surgeon? Why is it that if you get depression, Christians tell you, oh, just pray, have more faith? It's just not true. You do that, you hold on to God, you hold on to God's community, but by all means, get help from a professional. That's where I end. Thank you for your attention.